Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
$3 billion isn't much more than pocket change in the grand scheme of the financial crisis. That's how much the business lender CIT Group needed to survive. The fact that they got it even after the government said no, that's exactly the way things are supposed to work. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
American Public Media presents After the Bell, a weekly podcast that makes sense of the week in business and the economy, available at marketplace.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Good to have you with us on this Monday, everybody. Today is the 20th of July. CIT was in a tough spot. Too small to be too big to fail. Too big to vanish without some kind of ripple effect for the small and medium-sized businesses that it lends to. So when the White House said no chance to a federal bailout, everybody assumed Chapter 11 was the next step. But no. Today, the company is said to have reached a $3 billion deal with its bondholders that will keep it out of bankruptcy and, in the process, make the White House look pretty smart. Tamara Keith reports now from Washington.
A big financial firm is in trouble, and the government opts not to step in. Then disaster. That's what happened when the Bush administration allowed Lehman Brothers to fail. Ever since, the ghost of Lehman has haunted the halls of Washington. Until now.
The administration believed that CIT just wasn't Lehman, that you can't rescue everybody.
Douglas Elliott is a fellow with the Brookings Institution. He says the fact that CIT didn't fall into the abyss, that its bondholders are stepping in, suggests the markets have stabilized enough that regulators can take some chances.
They don't have to basically stamp out any little fire just because it might turn into a forest fire. They can afford to let some things go and see what happens.
Elliott says it gives the administration the political capital to say no next time if they think that's the right thing to do.
They can not only make the arguments that they did, that this isn't big enough that we have to save, but they can also say, look, the creditors will probably work something out here.
Maybe, just maybe, this means that larger financial institutions could be left to their own devices, says Dennis Santiago. He's CEO of Institutional Risk Analytics in Torrance, California.
We could get back to the normal state of affairs where companies come and go and do their thing in the normal free market process. Geez, that would kind of be nice, wouldn't it?
CIT's story is far from over. Even though it may have avoided bankruptcy this week, analysts say it's going to take quite a restructuring for CIT to survive in the long term. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
Take one recession, a banking crisis, and two wars. Total up the cost, and the bottom line is likely to top more than $9 trillion in borrowing on the federal balance sheet. Financing that debt means the Treasury Department's going to have to sell a lot of bonds, mostly to well-heeled foreign investors. And that, in turn, means Timothy Geithner has become something of an itinerant traveling salesman. And as Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports now from Washington, the Treasury Secretary has been finding some skeptical customers out there.
Foreigners own nearly half the government's publicly traded debt. So over the past few weeks, Geithner has been to China, Europe, and the Middle East, trying to convince governments and corporations the U.S. is still a good, safe place to invest. But with this year's deficit already at a record $1 trillion, some foreign investors are worried about the soundness of their cash. And Geithner isn't the only one facing skeptics. At a speech last Friday, White House economist Lawrence Summers fielded this question from a Chinese journalist.
So how will you assure the Chinese government and also the world investors that investment in the United States is safe?
Summers said the biggest threat to U.S. creditworthiness is a collapsing economy. And that, he said, justifies deficit spending right now.
We need to rescue this economy first, but we are very focused, and the president has made very clear his commitment to bringing down the rate of debt.
With the whole world in recession, the dollar is still a safe haven. Economic consultant Everett Ehrlich says that works in the U.S.'s favor.
There's an element of the old doctrine of mutually assured destruction that we applied to thermonuclear war that goes on here.
If foreigners abandon the U.S., that would threaten their own exports, Ehrlich says.
On the other hand, if they get the view that some of their number are going to do so, then no one wants to be the second person or worse, the last person out the door, which is how runs and panics start.
And just the scenario the traveling Treasury salesman is trying to avoid. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
All right, so much for Treasury bills, traditionally the safest of safe investments. Now on to some riskier fare. Financial firms are raising billions of dollars to create a whole new slew of new real estate investment trusts, or REITs. REITs make real estate loans, and they buy them, too. The new REITs are going to focus on buying commercial mortgages at deep, deep discounts. And their timing looks pretty good, because the commercial real estate market, simply put, is a mess. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler puts commercial property in the context of the wider mortgage crisis.
The number of borrowers that have fallen behind on their commercial mortgages has doubled in the last year. Retailers like Circuit City and Sharper Image have gone bankrupt, leaving buildings empty all over the country. Barry Ritholtz is CEO of the financial research firm Fusion IQ.
I suspect that this is going to be an ongoing problem that will get worse and worse over the next 2 to 4 quarters.
Many of these mortgages were made by small and mid-sized regional banks. Ritholtz says they've been reluctant to acknowledge that many of those loans are now underwater.
The fear is if they actually take the legitimate write-downs, that they'll be pretty illiquid and pretty close to insolvent.
So many banks are restructuring the commercial mortgages, though that's often a short-term solution.
It's likely that when someone is restructured, there's a pretty good chance, maybe 1 in 3, that they're going to eventually default.
That's Christopher Whalen with Institutional Risk Analytics. He says not being straight about their financial situation could leave some banks dead on their feet.
It will cost the banking industry and ultimately the taxpayer, if we have to subsidize it, more money if you keep the zombies open.
But he says it's not just the banks that are reluctant to admit they are bleeding red ink. Federal and state regulators worry that coming clean could leave some small communities without a bank.
They know when the banks are closed, the assets will be sold, and there may not be a community bank there ever again. So there's a big political dimension here. Don't kid yourself.
But because these banks are propping up these troubled mortgages, they have less money to make new loans that small businesses need. That slows economic growth, potentially prolonging the recession. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
That CIT deal did wonders for the mood on Wall Street. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. One person's financial crisis is another's business opportunity. We saw that with the bank earnings that started coming out last week, and we saw it again today in the pages of the New York Times this morning. Subprime mortgage brokers have engineered themselves a new lease on life. Companies that made millions in subprimes have started selling loan modifications to some of those same borrowers who are now at risk of losing their homes. Peter Goodman is the national economic correspondent at the New York Times. He had the article in this morning's paper. Peter, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
I want to make sure I have this story right, because I saw it this morning. I didn't quite believe it. These former subprime brokers are now in the loan modification business somehow. It seems almost Kafkaesque.
Yeah, it's kind of an amazing evolution, but that's what it is. I mean, the mortgage market collapsed, and people who got real skilled at working through the financial system to extract nice cuts for themselves, putting people into loans that in frequent cases went bad for the homeowners, had to figure out some new way to make a living. And they followed the money. The money's in what's known as loan modifications, calling up banks and mortgage servicers and trying to negotiate a better deal for homeowners.
Is that the sales pitch? Listen, we know how this works. We know all the bad things that happened to you, so we can fix it?
Very much so. I mean, there are multiple sales pitches. One of them is that exactly. Who knows better than a former mortgage broker than the ins and outs of the nettlesome beast that you're dealing with and trying to negotiate? But also, a lot of these firms, like the one I wrote about, market themselves as law firms. And that's partially a regulatory function in that in states like California, where you can't collect upfront fees unless you're a law firm, this allows them to say, hey, you're sending us a retainer, so you pay us before anything happens. But that's also a sales pitch to the customer. You know, you're dealing with a lawyer, even though you're not, chances are, really dealing with a lawyer.
Is this all legal?
Well, it's not legal according to the Federal Trade Commission, which is suing the company that I wrote about and a bunch of other companies, now more than a dozen, and there are 23 states that are going after companies that are making, as they say, fraudulent claims about what they can do for people, in some cases, as in California, collecting upfront fees even though they're not really allowed to do so, or fronting as law firms even though they're not really law firms. But there's a lot of ambiguity there. And so, I mean, if somebody really has a lawyer in charge, like this company FedMod did, then they can argue that they are a law firm. They can collect the fees up front, and they can market their services the way they did.
Are these guys actually helping anybody, though? Have they successfully modified loans and kept people in their houses?
They've certainly modified some loans, though it's very hard to get a handle on what percentage. I mean, anecdotally, it doesn't seem to be higher than 25%. And that's, you know, assuming that they're being fairly selective about the cases they're taking, I mean, which is what they say they're doing. And they're still only doing maybe one out of four. I mean, some say they're doing 70%, 80%, though that's unsubstantiated. The problem is that the mortgage servicers themselves, as we've written about in past stories, just don't seem all that motivated to go ahead and cut a better deal. I mean, they have to deal with investors who are actually the owners of a lot of these mortgages, and some seem to be dragging their feet as they put it, try to increase staffing, or as critics assert, as they wait for maybe a better deal from the federal government before they go ahead and cut a better deal for the homeowner.
Peter Goodman is the national economic correspondent at the New York Times. He's got a book coming out. It's called Past Due, The End of Easy Money and the Renewal of the American Economy. Peter, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you very much.
No matter how bad the economy gets, there are some things people just aren't going to skimp on. Organic food may be, or a good blast of air conditioning if it's real hot. Those are businesses that you figure would do well despite the recession. And that is the thought behind our series, The Upside. Today, a decidedly non-human expense. Some people just can't stop pampering their pets. And that makes doggy daycare a pretty good bet.
This is Rocky. They look like they're twins, but they're not. This is Stanley.
My name is Andrew Kim, and the name of the business is Healthy Spot. Our primary focus is on nutrition. We carry natural, holistic, raw and raw alternative food. We have a small dog daycare service, grooming, pet massage therapy, and a variety of other services. We have not felt the impact of the recession. We've been able to grow steadily in this environment. I've heard customers comment that they rather cut back on all their personal expenses before they cut back on the proper care for their dog.
My name is Kathleen, and I brought my Molly girl, she's a dachshund, in for her spa bath. There are some things that people just do. And if you like your dog and you're good to your dog, then you try and keep them healthy and happy. And recession or not, sometimes that's important.
A lot of us walked away from maybe more financially rewarding opportunities to work here or start this business because, one, we get to bring our dogs to work. Two, when you're working and you're in an environment where people feel like you're helping them, it just feels good. There's something really good about that.
That was Andrew Kim at the Healthy Spot out in Santa Monica, California. Coming up, paying for the race to space.
Well, people seem to think that we run to the moon and throw out $28 billion onto the moon and leave it there. But in fact, the entire Apollo program was a fantastic economic stimulus program.
But first, let's do the numbers. My, oh my, traders must have rested up over the weekend. The Dow Industrials put on 1.1%, 104 points, closed at 8,848. The NASDAQ stepped up 1.2%, 22 points, ended at 1909, its highest level all year. Ditto for the S&P 500. It turned in its highest finish since last November, gained 1.1%, 10 points. wrapped up at 9:51. As we told you earlier, CIT is on the mend. That lifted the bank stock 78%, but you can still buy a share for $1.25, just to put things into perspective there. Bank of America threw off 5%. Citibank gave back more than 7% today. And talk about big numbers. Investors in Human Genome Sciences nearly tripled their money on a 276% gain today. Its new lupus drug did well in a clinical trial. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation, seeking to increase American understanding of East and Southeast Asia. We've got all the business news worth talking about on our new blog. Scott Jagow hosts the Marketplace Scratchpad. You can check in with him throughout the trading day at marketplace.org.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Senate Judiciary Committee is scheduled to vote on the nomination of Sonia Sotomayor to the Supreme Court. The House Financial Services Committee holds a hearing titled Systematic Risk. Are some institutions too big to fail? And if so, what should we do about it? And the President and First Lady are slated to attend a White House event celebrating country music. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The story of the healthcare debate is going to seesaw back and forth over the next couple of weeks between a discussion on the economic merits and political calculus. President Obama did a little bit of both today. He met with staff at the National Children's Medical Center in Washington this afternoon, after which he stepped up to the microphones.
Now, there are some in this town who are content to perpetuate the status quo, are in fact fighting reform on behalf of powerful special interests.
That is the political part, but he talked economics too.
We all know there are more efficient ways of doing it. We just spoke to the chief information officer here at the hospital, and he talked about some wonderful ways in which we could potentially gather up electronic medical records and information for every child, not just that comes to this hospital, but in the entire region. And how much money could be saved, and how the health of these kids could be improved.
Digital medical records could cut down on office visits. They would let people transfer their records more easily. But for doctors, going electronic could be complicated, it could be expensive, and it could be nothing at all like what they learned in medical school. Marketplace's Caitlin Carroll reports.
Thomas Moore runs Pediatric Partners, a large medical group in Southern California.
And how did you sleep last night?
He's just finishing up with a young patient.
He slept okay, just on and off.
Moore's days are full of pint-sized patients suffering from ear infections, runny noses, and chicken pox. Lately, he's also started seeing a lot of adults. But they're not here for his medical expertise. They're here to check out his electronic medical records.
We had a large group come through from Texas a few weeks ago, and they really want to go with the system. But they brought their physicians who were sort of the naysayers. And by the end, they were pretty convinced that this was the way to go.
Moore's a pioneer when it comes to electronic medical records. His clinic first digitized its files in 2003. It was a disaster.
Every time we upgraded the system with more software, it would lock, and we would lose data, and people would be frustrated. So we scrapped it.
A couple years later, Moore took a deep breath and tried again. This time it worked, but he hasn't forgotten how hard it was the first time. All the questions and concerns, very few answers.
Physicians are scared. They're busy, so they're scared it's going to slow them down.
That's not the only fear. Jonah Frolick is with the nonprofit California Healthcare Foundation.
This is a big investment for them. It's $25,000 minimum per doctor. It's probably more like 40.
And the industry is so new, there are few standards. Doctors don't know which systems are best and which companies are going to be around for the long haul.
It leaves an underlying question here, which is, how do practices make that decision in the first place? Because many of them really don't have very good guidance.
So far, only about a quarter of doctors and hospitals have gone electronic. And with the addition of government incentives, what has been a slow-growing market could explode into a billion-dollar business. Lindy Benton is the chief operating officer of Sage Healthcare, a medium-sized medical records company. She deals mostly with small practices and clinics. Her reps are busy trying to sign doctors up, but it's a delicate job, holding their hands while pushing them along.
The questions that we get most often asked are, how much will it cost? How would I set my practice up? Will it change the way I practice?
I can click and see what they need. This lady needs a refill on sleeping aids. Since I know that they're all here, I can.
That's Dr. Bobby Katz. He runs a busy obstetrics practice in Beverly Hills. Katz chose Sage to take his practice digital. He says computerizing his records has paid off in better medicine. The decision was still daunting, though.
You're talking to a doctor who doesn't know anything about this stuff. Fortunately, we have an excellent office manager who did a lot of screening for us.
A small office could spend over $100,000 in the first 5 years for hardware, software, and IT support. And it's critical to get everything you need built into the system from the start. Sandra Coutel is the manager for Katz's practice.
It can become extremely expensive if there are a lot of add-on costs. And that of course, is a pitfall whenever you're dealing with something that you're not familiar with. It's not like going and buying furniture.
The systems are complicated. They need to be customized to individual practices. And every new application comes with its own price tag, kind of like healthcare. In Los Angeles, I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace.
If you're out walking the dog tonight or just running some errands, take a second and look up. You won't see much more than a sliver of the moon, but run this soundtrack through your mind all the same.
10, 9, ignition sequence starts. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, all engine running. Liftoff, we have a liftoff, 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
40 years ago tonight, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walked on the moon. Anybody who was alive back then and old enough to remember probably won't ever forget where they were.
It was during the summer, so I was in between my junior and senior year in high school.
I was outside playing, and my mother made me come in to watch.
Yeah, I was at home watching it on television with my parents. My dad was 54 years old, born in 1915, so it was really an event from going from Model Ts to men landing on the moon.
There are plans now in the works to put another man or a woman on the moon, but given the economy and everything else that has to be done in this country, should we?
We got to keep up with technology. We got to keep up with the rest of the world.
Exploration like that never should have never stopped. There's always something new and exciting out there, and it's plus it keeps the jobs for the guys that are doing it.
I think we could spend that money on taking care of Earth, and then we'll worry about getting to the moon when Earth is back in order.
David Schmidt, Deirdre Colley, Renee Benson, and Jerry Pulliam helped us out with our public opinion research this afternoon here in Los Angeles. Last week, I spoke with author Craig Nelson. His new book on the lunar landing and what it took to get there is called Rocket Men. And I asked him if he thinks we're going to go back to the moon anytime soon.
I actually don't think that's going to happen until we have competition like we had in the Cold War. You know, there's a misreading of history where people look at that Apollo era and think that we've gone downhill or NASA's deteriorated because we don't have that kind of giant program anymore. But really, it was a Cold War battlefield, and the Cold War's over, and that's why that isn't happening. But I do think that competition is going to heat up again, and we are going to have that coming back in 10 to 15 years.
Yeah, we don't have the Russians and Khrushchev trying to get there, but we do have the Chinese saying they will.
Well, the Chinese and the Indians, and in fact, Russia has two programs. It has both a state and a private space industry going at the same time. So they may come back and be competition with us all over again.
But at a time when the federal budget deficit for this year is $1 trillion in the first 9 months and trillions more to come, there are a lot of people who are listening to this broadcast who are saying, you people are out of your minds. We can't afford to take care of ourselves in healthcare, let alone go to the moon.
Well, people seem to think that we run to the moon and throw out $28 billion onto the moon and leave it there. But in fact, the entire Apollo program was a fantastic economic stimulus program for all of the South. All of the Gulf Coast states were revolutionized as far as tech jobs it brought to that region. And you look at it, and it's not just engineers and scientists that were boosted by that giant program. It was seamstresses and plumbers and welders. It was a really remarkable economic stimulus for its time. And we could certainly use that money again.
Other than because it's there, is there a valid economic reason to go to the moon?
People think that there's a process of using fusion out of helium-3, which is a substance that's very common on the moon and very rare on the Earth. And we could have dramatic changes in our energy requirements and needs if helium-3 proves to be a useful source of energy and if it can be successfully mined off the moon and transferred here. There's also the possibility of using the moon as a giant source of solar energy since the sun never sets on certain parts of it. So if they can figure out a way to make that practical, and if we have the revolution in booster technology we may have in the next couple of years, both of those things may happen.
How much of the debate, though, over whether to go back to the moon, and in fact some of the battles in Washington that NASA has had over the past two, three, four decades about whether to build a shuttle and the space station, how much of that is because NASA is just really not good at selling itself and selling its product?
I think a lot of it is because of that, and I think there's a lack of knowledge going on with the general public, and that a lot of people see the space agency as being something very divorced from their day-to-day lives, whereas, in fact, the huge part of the agency is directly related to people's day-to-day lives, and it's really a shame that ordinary people don't really understand all the benefits they get from having NASA.
Well, here's your chance. Run down the list for us.
NASA does incredible things for agriculture by surveying the Earth. And we've had incredible changes in technology from the rate of computers to plastics and MRI and dialysis machines and equipment for firefighters. And the list just goes on and on and on, the benefits that come off this. So it certainly isn't throwing money at the moon.
Do you think we ought to go back to the moon?
Well, I think that if it's discovered that one of these things is worthwhile, the solar energy or the helium-3, then yes, we should go back. But to go back to use it as a base to go to Mars, I don't see the point of that yet until we start seeing competition in these other areas.
Craig Nelson, his book on the Apollo program is called Rocket Men. Craig, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
These final notes today, two government reports you might find interesting. First, the Government Accountability Office said today the Food and Drug Administration needs more finance experts. The GAO said the FDA doesn't have the in-house expertise to manage its own budget. The FDA is set to get $2.35 billion in next year's spending plan, plus whatever it gets from drug companies paying for product reviews. Also, this from the government's Special Inspector General for Bailouts in a report set to hit the street tomorrow. Neil Barofsky says in the worst possible case, the government's total losses could hit $24 trillion. And on that depressing, although definitely unlikely note, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 104 points, 1.1%. The NASDAQ gained 22 points, 1.2%. The S&P 500 packed on 10 points, 1.1% there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Coming up next time on the broadcast, how the bond market helps keep cities afloat.
With a municipality, if it pays a lower interest rate, it can do more investing in roads and other projects.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.